accession number 30493, reel 11.
So there we are, memory and versus diaries, or diaries versus memory. So it's a very weird process at work, I think, at the moment, in my head.
Was there any degree to which, during your time in the Middle East, you experienced a positive aspect of British imperialism?
Well, I mean, the main thing was to defeat Hitler. Everything was. Look how Churchill was. The only thing that mattered to Churchill then, it's true, later on he said, I've not been elected Prime Minister of Britain in order to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire. He's famous for having said that, I think. You see, Churchill, I mean, when we were on Cyprus, he paid a secret visit. I don't know whether I've told you this. Totally secret. He'd met Roosevelt somewhere, I think, and then he interrupted his flight back home by landing in Cyprus because his regiment was there. I think it's the 4th Hussars, an infantry regiment, and he'd been connected with that, perhaps back from the Boer War, I don't know. But he made this secret visit. Now, we might have suffered horribly from that visit because we were practicing in the mountains, as I say, with the infantry, the 4th Hussars, and the Indian infantry in the 10th Indian Division. And Churchill thought, oh, yes, well, all this well-trained body of men. He wanted to retake Rhodes. Now, I've read all this up since, of course. It's all the secret doctrines are out. He wanted to recapture Rhodes from the Germans, so they had invaded it and occupied it. And he went to the high command, Eisenhower, and he said, look, we can't let Hitler get away with occupying Rhodes. And I've got a unit in, we've got a unit in the Cyprus, all well trained, ready for mountain warfare. I've got the code name somewhere. He set up two schemes, each with the code. And it's there, as I say, it's all in the history books now. But happily for us, I mean, I think we'd have been smashed, destroyed by the Nazi defenders. And that would have been the end of me and the rest of the 10th Indian Division, I think, if we'd even got off the beaches. Anyway, of course, I knew nothing about this at the time. But Eisenhower happily says, sorry, Winnie, or words to that effect, we want that unit for the invasion of Italy. You know, they're well trained for mountain warfare. That's why we sent them to Cyprus. And Churchill was angry about it, but he accepted the high command decision, because he too wanted to invade Italy. This was the soft underbelly of Europe, believe it or not. The soft underbelly. How stupid and ignorant they were. Italy, soft underbelly. One bloody mountain range after another. No wonder the campaign just totally bogged down in 1944. Utterly and truly, there is my diary. It's day by day, I report the mud, the rain, the snow, the roads disappearing. I mean, the Nazis blew up every railway, every culvert, every bridge, every road, whole stretches of road from the side of the mountains just disappeared. And the Royal Engineers, they're the heroes of the war, you know, building their Bailey bridges, repairing the roads, round the clock. True heroes, you know. People think of a war hero as somebody with a gun charging at the enemy, but these guys were building bridges and digging and rebuilding roads. Incredible achievement in Italy. All forgotten. What did that start with now? Your question.
I think asking before about the any merit to British imperialism you'd have
yes. Yes, well there we are, only connect one thing leads to another. British imperialism, well, Churchill of course was an imperialist, but he wasn't building empires then. He was certainly wanted to defend British possessions. And the empire just dwindled away quite so rapidly after the war, didn't it? Just disappeared. There again, I knew that was going to happen. Isn't that extraordinary? Because one day a guy walked into the shop and he helped to organise the 5th Pan-African Congress. There again, you see, I'm linking up all the time, leaping, but connecting, because it's all part and parcel of the same process. You ask about imperialism. Well, I think about all the people who wanted to end it because we'd occupied them for hundreds of years. And those guys from different parts of the empire, they all came to Manchester in 1945. I was delighted that this year, the BBC, actually, all these years later, noticed that this had happened. And they got a woman who's a great historian to tell the story of the 5th Pan-African Congress that took place in Manchester in 1945. This is a tremendous historic occasion. Absolutely. And these guys from all over the world, they came together and they had this conference and they said, we are determined to be free. We will throw out our colonial masters. Now, 1945 was a big joke. I mean, how could these unknown guys, black and brown and yellow, go away and bring the British Empire to an end? And they did that very thing. It's a tremendous bit of history. And there's quite a few books about it, but do the British know about it? For the most part, no. Except those who tuned into the BBC a few weeks ago. What a story it is. Now, one of the organisers of that, Cedric Dover, he walked into our bookshop in Hammersmith in 1948, and he changed my awareness of the world. I had another amazing stage, because he told me that the British Empire was going to disappear, you know, and Africa would be free of the white man. Now, he wasn't crazy, you see. He was very well informed. So, and he was such a nice man, so convincing. He broadcast during the war on the BBC programme aimed at India, and one of his fellow broadcasters was George Orwell, and he had stories to tell about George Orwell. Anyway, I mean, from that point on, I started everywhere finding books about Africa. Now, most books about Africa are about hunting, shooting, and fishing and exploration, you know. But there was a literature, very hard to find, of critical work, you know. A handful of people who wanted to end colonialism. And I began to build up that literature. And eventually, I had put out a catalogue, just when these guys, in fact, had thrown out the white man. Nkrumah now was president of Ghana, you see. And just at this historic time, out comes a catalogue that took years for us to put together, with 4,000 books and pamphlets on the history of Africa, the true history of Africa, insofar as it was available in the printed word. And the response, you see, academics all over the world were going to their university libraries and saying, what's happening, you know, the British Empire is disappearing, what books have we got about it? And of course they'd had nothing about Africa. We weren't informed much during the war about such matters, no.
Prior to arriving in Cyprus, you had been training in Egypt and Palestine and the area? Or?
Yes, my diary is full of training exercises under all conditions. You see, at the beginning we expected to go, be sent into the Western Desert and chase after Rommel, but that was going so well, we weren't needed, so we ended desert training, which actually rather enjoyed, actually firing our guns at a moving target, because we expected not distant enemy, but an enemy that was charging us in tanks across the sand. And so we were taught to fire over open sights. And number three was literally looking at the man who was trying to kill you in his armoured car or his tank, and you had this target towed across the desert, and it was rather enjoyable to sort of take pot shots at this target, you know. But then that came to an end, as I say, and then it was evasion exercises took place. Then we were split up for some reason. The details are quite well chronicled in my diary, but not in my head. Except that I know we trained a lot. It's endless training, different camps, different parts of Lebanon, and the menace again was nature. Malaria was laying the troops low on a terrible, frightening scale, and then the question of mosquito nets and anti-mosquito cream, and then of course I kept getting jobs of work to do. This idea of a soldier being a worker. An academic wrote to us from Southampton University. He said he was writing a book, English fiction of the Second World War. Alan Munton. So I was able to. I was delighted. I thought, oh yes, well we can help you, Mr. Munton. And in his acknowledgements, he says here, to Ronald Gray, I'm grateful for books, wartime memories, and sound advice. And on page 32, he quotes from one of my letters to him. This is quite interesting. He says, the majority of the army were working class men who spent most of their time as labourers. Then he says, as a former gunner put it, that's me, army, then he quotes from my letter, army work, this is quite significant actually, and important I think, army work was marching and drilling, constant cleaning of guns and vehicles, digging latrines, digging waste pits, digging trenches, digging gun pits, and digging dugouts, cooking meals, waiting on officers. A soldier's military training and skills are used periodically, but work and boredom predominate. That piece says, this recognition of war as work is most uncommon. That's it, that's what it was. It was work. It comes out, I realise it comes out very well in my diaries. I report what we're doing on the gun. It's just, and it, the sense of, as you read from day to day, the sense of it just being a routine job. You do without thinking. After those years of training, you're doing it almost without thinking. And everything else is work. I mean, work and work and work. And then, when I think of the number of jobs I did in the army, it's extraordinary. I mean, in my pay book, it said profession. I was stupid enough to write, I should have written independent businessman. Or something like that, because I was working for my dad. Instead, I wrote, I think I wrote fruiterer and greengrocer or something like that. So, of course, an officer might say, oh, yes, a shopkeeper, you know. And I was often called on to do, to help with the canteen work. I had a sergeant over me, but then I'd have to serve the guys from behind the counter with beer and et cetera, drinks. And the interesting thing, good thing about it was, we had to drive right along the coast, the Lebanese coast, to Palestine for supplies. And went to Tel Aviv, I think, where the supply base was. So one job led to another, you know. And then I've done my share of waiting on in sergeants' messes and officers' mess. In an observation post. Now, the most dangerous job I ever had was going up to an observation post. Now, I was just a worker there, if you come think of it. What was my job? The first thing, I had to dig a latrine for everybody. There are four of us. There's the officer, observation post officer. He's got a sergeant with him and a signaller. And then there was me, dog's body, really. First of all, I dig a latrine for everybody. I have to some fish around. And of course, everything has to be done silently. So it's quite a skillful job, you might say. Because the enemy's just quarter of a mile away. You can actually see him, you know, sunbathing. So you're very close. And you have to be very quiet because they're listening devices. So I dig latrines. Next job, it's time for breakfast. I have to cook. But I mentioned bacon, eggs and hot tea. For four, there I am, being a cook, right? And then suddenly the officer calls down, Gray, we need an escape route pretty smartly, just in case shells come this way. I don't want to have to go down the back stairs or something like that. You get your penknife out. And I got something out anyway. And there I was, chipping away. There again, it had to be all silent, you know. You're chipping away at the ceiling and removing two layers of bricks, if I remember. It took me hours and hours, silently, making a hole in the ceiling. So, you know, this is all labouring jobs. All labouring is work, you know. You're not firing guns while you're doing that, or rifles, or machine guns. It's jobs of work. And the digging, I mean, the amount of digging, as I mentioned there, dig, dig, dig. We had to dig the officer's latrines, of course, wherever we were. We came into a new site, officer's latrines, and the men's latrines came second, you know. lots of officers had comfortable craps because I'd prepared the dug latrine for them. Yes, it's true. People don't understand that side of the army. Then the other, then it's the boredom. Now, boredom, there's another enormous issue with boredom because it decides the behaviour of the troops when it comes to think of it. Yes, the fussle This chap who wrote Great War and Modern Memory, he wrote, it's interesting, he wrote, there is no artistic technique for dealing with boredom. Now, Paul Fussell, he wrote that in his book Wartime, which is reviewed by Anthony Burgess. Now, I've written, under that, I've written, I disagree. Keeping a war diary, getting permission to keep and use a camera under battle conditions, and above all, reading from an extra kit bag full of books, serve one well in the fight against boredom, as well as the fight against the enemy. And at the end I put, and then there was the swimming, the seas and rivers. It's possible to fight boredom, you see. But, of course, I was fortunate, you see. I was just a lucky, lucky man. Most guys had no way of coping with boredom. Get playing cards and boozing if the money was available. Sad. So I realised the importance. And I left school at 14. It's not as though I'd been educated at all.
Would that then have an effect on their own morale and performance?
That's a big question, isn't it? It really is. The key to that answer, I think, is an awareness of the dependence of on each other. You knew as an individual, you know, you're dead, you know, that as a team, know each other, work well together, you'll survive, you know, or you hope you will. And it didn't matter, you know, what your level of education or awareness was. You became there's discipline. Is discipline, I have to admit, though I hate it. It's absolutely essential in the army, yes. It was a terrible conflict in Spain, in the Spanish Civil War, between the anarchists and then the communist leadership. And the communists were really brutal, and they victimized, they murdered the anarchists very often. Because the anarchists' idea of war, you see, they were brave men. A lot of them were miners from the Asturias. And the Asturias miners revolted years before. I'm sorry, I'm leaving one subject to another as usual, but it's all relevant in my book. And the anarchist attitude to war, yes, you go out there and you charge at the enemy and bang, bang, bang. And then you rush off back home to your farm. You know, I spend the night at home with the wife and family. And, I mean, after all, the anarchist doesn't believe in government, doesn't believe in authority or the police. In fact, if you read the anarchist books like by Bakunin and the Prince Kropotkin, you think, oh, marvellous, you know, who wouldn't want to live under anarchism? No bosses, no police force, no army, nobody telling you what to do. You know, you utterly and totally free. So the army, you ask men like that to go and fight an enemy, they'll want to be brave and they'll go out there and take some pot shots and then they rush off again and sleep in a nice warm bed, you know. And we can understand the communists were utterly, totally ruthless in their attitude to war. So you had this murderous conflict between them, which helped, of course, to defeat the revolt against Franco. You know, that's all very relevant, you see. You start to think about what makes a man fight, what his motivation. And so discipline, yes, is absolutely essential, no doubt about it. If it's not there, you go to pieces. cut to pieces.
Did individual and army attitudes as a whole to the local populations and vice versa change much depending on the areas that you were stationed in the Middle East?
Well, as I said, I've explained the army attitude was pretty unforgivable in Egypt. In Palestine, well, of course, the difference was most of the Jews in Palestine spoke English, of course. So you could communicate wherever you bumped into the roads in a bus queue or on leaving some place. There was communication, and that's everything, isn't it? You suddenly, somebody who's just labelled by his ethnicity, you suddenly see it's just an ordinary human being, and there's the beginning of wisdom about other nations, other peoples, other races. Meet them, talk to them. Ah, they're human beings like me. Well. Big discovery for a lot of people. So it varied. Where there was communication, for instance, Italy, well, there again, language. I'm so ashamed that I didn't learn the language better in Italy while I was there. I really am. I learned a sort of pidgin English, pidgin Italian, helped, but I should have learned the language while I was there. Ridiculous. Shameful. So they're getting difficulty. Quite a few tenants did know a bit of English, so there was some communication when we got talking. But there again, we suddenly, the eye ties, we always call them the eye ties, which is, you know, a humiliating label, isn't it? We used to say, because the eye ties, we had this image of Italian cowardice on the run in North Africa. The Italians didn't want to fight for Mussolini, and they did run when they had the chance, and sensible of them, jolly good luck to them. They did. They didn't want to fight for Mussolini. So when King Badoglio ended the alliance with Hitler, and Mussolini became a fugitive, North Italy. Our attitude, of course, changed suddenly. Italians were our allies, just like that, almost overnight. And wherever we appeared, you know, there they were, happy to see us. I mean, there's quite a lot of that in the diary. Yet, I mean, sometimes wine would flow. You know, they'd bring out bottles of wine, and there'd be that joy in their faces. Which is wonderful to see. I might want to remark on it. And of course, as I played that bit back on the tape just now, we got and lived with them, you see, right in the front line. Extraordinary, when I look back. Although I'd forgotten that, you see, no memory of living with an Italian family in the front line. Isn't it amazing? I should remember that, shouldn't I? Is that family, as I say, Mama, Papa, and this beautiful young woman of 18 or so. She's a delight to have around us six staff soldiers, I can tell you. And her bright young brother. And there we were for some weeks in this house. And there's our gun just outside. Sorry, the mic's dropped off. Inside their house, banging away, the house threatening to fall down every time we fired. So involvement with tenants did take place quite a lot, you know. And there was another place I remember where they went on living It's amazing there how brave they were. They didn't want to leave their land, their little homes. And they went with a war going right through their town or village or countryside. I think a lot of us developed a great respect for the Italians after having regarded them as cowards. And in the village, and what I think the most awful thing that I heard said about the Italians was when I got home after the war. I thought I'd visit the neighbours next door, and I said, "Hello, I'm back from the war." What's that effect? And they said, "Oh yes, where have you been?" I said, "Oh, in Italy." And he said, "Oh, Italy. They're very dirty people, aren't they?" And I thought, English people regarded the Italians as dirty people. And I'd seen all of us had seen the women in outside the village beating their clothes in the water without any soap. And wherever he went, the women were down by a stream or somewhere, keeping themselves clean, and then without soap or detergent. And they had to do it the hard way. And I come back home and people, next door neighbours, tell me that what dirty people they are. Shameful, these attitudes.